Talk to the community. Go talk to the people who suffer directly from this bill, which was based largely upon the idea that I, as a transgender person, can cause harm to somebody else in a bathroom just by simply being there, which is a hurtful and unfounded statement based on bias and animosity towards the LGBT community in North Carolina. So I would tell them, learn a little bit about these issues, learn a little bit about who we are as a people, and learn a little bit more about our background and the things that we go through.
Peyton McGarry, 20-year-old trans student at University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Peyton is a plaintiff in the federal lawsuit filed by the ACLU challenging a new North Carolina law banning local governments from passing laws prohibiting discrimination against LGBT people in public accommodations. And that, if you want to see the whole interview with Peyton, go to democracynow.org. That does it for our show. We begin our 20th anniversary 100-city tour around the country next week. I'll be in Ithaca, New York on April 6th, Columbus, Ohio on the 8th, St. Louis and Columbia, Missouri and Kansas City on the 9th, and Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, California on the 10th. Go to democracynow.org for the whole tour. Democracy Now! Has job openings. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the evening news coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ben's Lee Schwab Amphitheater, presenting Widespread Panic's only Northwest shows, July 2nd and 3rd. Tickets for Widespread Panic's summer concerts are on sale Friday at benconcerts.com. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland boycotts the state of North Carolina.
KBOO reporter Robin Ryan speaks to NAACP about the shooting of 24-year-old Jamar Clark by police.
And live in studio, we have grassroots organizers Rain Lee Ritalto and Lisa Lake.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 30th, 2016. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Portland has joined a long list of cities taking North Carolina out of its travel plans in protest against new laws which many feel discriminate against the LGBT community. City leaders say no Portland employees will travel to the North Carolina area until legislators agree to scrap the controversial move. The Public Facilities Privacy and Securities Act prevents towns and cities in North Carolina from enacting ordinances which allow transgender people to use whichever bathroom they feel matches their gender identity, as well as effectively allowing businesses to refuse service to LGBT people for religious reasons. The North Carolina bill is in direct response to a law passed in the city of Charlotte, which offered broad protection from discrimination to lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender people. This is the second time Portland has made such a move. Last year, it implemented a similar ban on the back of Indiana's Religious Freedoms Bill.
We ran a story on Monday's KBOO News about the giant walnut tree on the site of Beaverton School District's newest high school. That high school, South Cooper Mountain, is currently under construction with plans to open in September of 2017. The development plans called for keeping the 80-year-old tree at the edge of the site on the corner of Southwest 175th Avenue and Shoals Ferry Road. But the tree was removed without prior word to the public during spring break of last year. According to Beaverton School District spokesperson Maureen Wheeler, the tree was cut down due to the need to build a retaining wall on the corner. Wheeler said that arborists from both the school district and the city of Beaverton examined the walnut tree and determined it would not be able to live through the planned construction, so the tree was removed. We asked the question yesterday, why didn't the arborist examine the tree and confer with planners last summer before the district committed to keeping it? We were able to follow up by phone with Maureen Wheeler just before the broadcast, but unfortunately not in time to air the interview during last night's news, so we do that now. KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Wheeler to find out more.
Maureen, the newest high school in the Beaverton School District, which is South Cooper Mountain, is currently under construction, and there was a giant walnut tree on the site at the corner of Southwest 175th and Shoals Ferry Road, but it's not there anymore as of the past week or so. What happened to the tree?
Well, it was an 80-year-old tree, and we had fully intended to be able to keep it. And when we had to construct a retaining wall on that corner property, it was part of our permit from the city to put in a retaining wall. It had to cut back into the property line. We had it evaluated by an arborist, and the arborist said, well, based on the age and the health of the tree, that it probably would not survive having to put down the borings to have the retaining wall held in place and that type of thing. So a decision was made to cut it down. It was just too close to the tree and really was going to cause more harm.
Now, last summer, as part of the development plan, the plan was to keep the walnut tree.
Exactly.
And I know there was some citizen, some testimony on that and how important it was to them. Why weren't the arborists called in at that time? Did they know about the need for that retaining wall and the sloping at the time?
Well, I think that, you know, we didn't have quite all of the designs done probably at the time, but as we're, you know, moving now on the full construction of the property, it became apparent that it was going to be very close to the tree and to the root system. And so it was really concerned for the health of the tree. And the arborist also from the city of Beaverton did go out and reached similar conclusion to the arborist that we asked to evaluate prior to the retaining wall going up. We did want to save it. So we did bring in the arborist to say, so we've got the designs for this retaining wall. This is the borings that we're going to have to do to hold that wall in place because it's on a slope. And they both concurred that, you know, with the current state health of the tree, it wasn't in as good a shape as it could have been. And then just the work that needed to happen would make it very difficult to survive. What we're going to be doing is modifying our landscaping plan, of course, working with the city of Beaverton, and replanting some trees. But yes, we kind of mourned the loss of that tree. It was it looked very lovely on that corner, but obviously wasn't going to make it through the construction.
Was there a public announcement made before the tree was cut down?
No.
I was telling you before we started recording the interview that I found out about it almost through the grapevine, through neighbors, people who drive by there every day, and now kind of miss that sight of the old walnut tree.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, some of these things happen as we're progressing on the construction project, and you have to kind of pivot and make some decisions because we're moving very fast to make sure that this school is open on time.
Now, you mentioned that to make up for the loss of this historic tree, there's a change in plans to maybe plant more trees. What I was concerned about, and I live in the Beaverton School District, and I know there's always a lot of support from the residents there in terms of passing every school bond. I also contribute, as a lot of my neighbors do, to the Beaverton Education Foundation. Are you concerned that kind of a breach of trust in cutting down the tree, at least some people might perceive it as that, will hurt efforts to raise money for the school district in the future?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for the support. We are indebted to the community. You know, we do our best work by you know, trying to do the planning that we can, and the forward planning that was to keep that tree in place, but it wasn't possible to keep it given the design and where we had to place the retaining wall. in the end. And so, you know, we do look for support from our community. We understand we love our trees. And in fact, we are planting thousands of trees in the wetlands area there and doing a number of other really beautiful plantings throughout the property. And I'm sure that, you know, there'll be some really good landscaping plans. Over time, it will be beautified, and, you know, I think will be pleasing to the community.
Now, hopefully enough people will listen to this broadcast, but if they don't, is there plans for a public announcement to explain what happened to the walnut tree?
We do regular updates, actually, on the bond project. And so we have one coming out in the spring, and we're going to have a mention in there about the tree, you know, what happened to the walnut tree, and have an explanation for folks. Because we are known for our trees in Beaverton, and on a number of our properties, we've got some beautiful trees, and, you know, we value them. We also want healthy trees, and this tree wasn't in particularly good health. It was an 80-year-old tree, walnut tree, and it apparently had been planted by the homesteader, so it had been there for a while. And unfortunately, just with construction, really would have disrupted the root system.
Have you received any feedback or comments from residents in the area about the loss of the tree? It's just within the past week or so, right?
Right. It was during spring break, so no, we've not received anything at this point. I wouldn't be surprised, but you know, it is gone at this point, and we're going to do our very best to modify the landscaping plan that we have with the city and work with them to get some beautiful landscaping in its place.
I was wondering if there's a site or a number or an email where people who are a little frustrated with the loss of the walnut tree can voice their opinions.
Sure. On our front webpage, we do have email us. It's a contact us. There's a button there that people can just fill out a form, and it comes to our community involvement office, and that's monitored on a regular basis. So.
And that's the Beaverton School District website.
Right. It's community_involvement@beaverton.k12.or.us.
We've been talking with Maureen Wheeler, the Beaverton School District's public communications officer. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
A new organization weaving together an array of...
If you're concerned about the impact you're...
Excuse me. A new organization weaving together an array of grassroots movements is starting up in the Portland area. Here to talk about it with us tonight are Rain Lee Ritalto and Lisa Lake. Lisa, Rain, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
To get started, why don't you each tell us a bit about how you got involved in activism in general?
Well, for me, it started with beekeeping, actually. I moved to from Portland to Gresham, and they didn't allow beekeeping, and I ended up having to lobby to get that approved, and in that process, it kind of brought some of the politics forward for me. And with my garden overproducing in squash, I posted out on Facebook about the abundance of squash that I had, and Free Hot Soup responded, and that's how I learned about the houseless issues. I ended up becoming a leader in Free Hot Soup. I created a group called Free Hot Soup Gresham that I ran for about a year and 4 months, and realized that I wanted to do more than just Band-Aid solutions. So I wanted to get at some systemic changes, and that when I met Lisa, it just really came together to create Advocacy 5, the new company that we have.
Yeah. I've been a longtime advocate for the houseless and other disenfranchised community members. Started a long time ago when I was a kid and wanted to feed everyone on the corner. And it grew into me kind of patrolling whatever neighborhood I lived in and actually feeding people on the corner. And then I saw that there were a bunch of different agencies out there doing the same thing, and started talking to Rain about how can we get this so that it's a movement that happens on a regular basis, at a regular time, you know, on a regular, consistent schedule.
So tell us about Advocacy 5 and how it works.
So Advocacy 5, we are looking, like I said, to make a systemic change. We really want to get at root causes, partnering with existing agencies, and really drill into what are the gaps? Because there's a lot of service gaps out there where folks have a hard time navigating existing services, if there are services. Some of our things that we're doing, we have some projects underway that are designed to look at those gaps and provide some pretty immediate solutions. So we can talk a little bit about that too. Right now, there's actually a lot of issues for women that are homeless. There's a lot of abuse that's going on out there for them, to where their safety is really a hard thing, and they're getting assaulted at an alarming rate. And I've had enough of them come forward to me from the trust that I've built up with them from Free Hot Soup and just telling me what's going on. And that really struck at my heart. And, you know, in Southeast Portland, there are no sanctioned camps like there are in North Portland. So those are something that we started talking to Josh Alpert, the Mayor Hill's chief of staff, about. And we picked out a site and started working on a model. And that's led to a proposal in the works. And it looks like there's going to be a sanctioned camp coming. But we also, in the meantime, didn't want to wait. And we had an opportunity with the Pay It Forward Stores, is a group that's becoming a nonprofit that Jim Anderson is running. And he had a trailer donated, a 27-foot trailer. And so we got offered the trailer, and we accepted that graciously. And we've been tearing that thing apart to rehab it down to as many beds as it'll be, so we can have portable emergency right now shelter for these women that are getting assaulted.
Yes.
Who have you partnered with, and how do your partnerships work?
We've partnered with many agencies, Boots on the Ground, which is kind of where we started as a grassroots movement of being out there on the streets when people were having difficulty finding shelter, where to camp, services. We've partnered with PDX Outreach Nursing. Shout out to Trish Baszler. And she is on the streets as a nurse, and we want more of that happening, along with some doctors. So these people can be seen and treated and, you know, sent to the hospital if they need to, and the women too. That's a big thing. So if we get a women's camp established, then all of these partners will come with us onto the women's campsite and really have great momentum already.
How do you get this information out to the houseless community, and how do they know how to get in touch with you, or how do they get in touch with you when they do need these emergency services?
Well, we actually have good connections out on the street because, like I said, I've spent 2 years now, 2.5 years with Free Hot Soup. So pretty much everybody on the street knows who I am.
And me too, in my neighborhood.
Yeah. So and our numbers are out there. Our people are out there. A lot of the folks that were on my crew still, you know, engage with me on a regular basis. Actually, I got a call right before coming in here about an incident that happened tonight, even that I was helping to triage.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit more about some of the social dynamics you're seeing playing out in East County specifically?
Yeah, East County doesn't have a lot of services, so it has no shelter of any kind other than, you know, your emergency warming shelter. And Gresham specifically has been struggling. I've met with them a few times, with some other activists folks too, to help get them sort of a toehold of starting, just to get to a start point of services. And one of the things that they've been very frank about is saying, we're not a social services agency. We just don't have these resources. So they're reaching out to partner with Join, but Join, as I understand, it's out of money till June, you know, so those services are sort of lagging behind. And meanwhile, the population of houseless folks in Gresham has grown a lot. So, you know, having really not much other than soup kitchen services available out there, and then having the population, you know, becoming larger, has been really problematic for them. And we're, you know, they're taking some good steps. They've formed a subcommittee on homelessness. They're reaching out to do a citizen-led task force on homelessness that I've applied to be on. So I think it's good progress. I was just a little frustrated with the city council protest because they are open and wanting to meet with folks, and evidently that engagement didn't occur. And then we had a protest situation happen, and we need to do a better job of building community together, you know, and I think that's really it. And people need to be a little more understanding in the process.
Well, speaking of community, what is your vision for an ideal community-based solution?
Oh, it's all the agencies coming together to serve the houseless neighbors. Camps are a reality now. They've been sanctioned in the north, in North Portland. They're soon to be sanctioned in Southeast Portland. I'm hoping that this gets to be more and more. We just open up more and more camps, and the agencies that we're working with will then be on call to help, you know, provide for those camps.
I think one key point of that, too, is right now the services are spread all over the city. And when you have sanctioned camps, there's an opportunity there to bring the services to the people in a group form. And I think that's what isn't happening that needs to happen. And hopefully that's something we can help make happen.
Our time is winding down here, but what would either of you want to say about what inspires you to do this work?
Every day, I just get up and think about how things can change and things can be better. And then I get a plan for the day, for the week, for the month, and I go after it. And Rain was doing the same thing. So us joining together is, you know, just the perfect union.
Yeah, I think for me, too, it's like on the street, the level of acceptance to me, like I just started going out my own and building this grid in a vacuum. And the level of acceptance that I've gotten from the actual homeless community has been overwhelming. And they've just, they're very, very accepting, very appreciative. So that's my inspiration.
So what are some ways our listeners can support Advocacy 5?
They can go to our website, which will be live on April 1st, Friday. It's Advocacy 5, either the number or written out 5.com. We'll have Facebook and Twitter and all of that aligned with that, and there'll be a direct donation button on all of our places.
And we're also hoping that folks will help with volunteering with us, get engaged in some of these projects, because we really want to build community. Yeah. That's how understanding comes about, and you know, better situation than what we have today.
So lots of opportunities to volunteer or donate.
Yes. The volunteers will actually be listed of what they can do and how they can do it.
Great. Well, we're just about out of time. Thanks, Rain. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Rain Lee Ritalto and Lisa Lake from Advocacy 5. Once again, if you want to find out more about the work they're doing, you can do that at www.advocacy5.com. That's Advocacy 5, all spelled out. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How eco-friendly is your new house? A new initiative from the City of Portland could make it law to disclose things like energy efficiency and carbon footprint to prospective buyers of detached family homes. KBOO's Les Hudson reports.
If you're concerned about the impact your home has on the environment, a new scheme proposed by City of Portland Planning and Sustainability could help you make better buying decisions in the future. Its proposed Home Energy Score scheme would make it mandatory for all sales of single-family homes to reveal how energy efficient they are to prospective buyers before the sale is finalized. The plan was first proposed back in 2009 as part of the City of Portland and Multnomah County Climate Action Plan, which seeks to reduce energy use from existing buildings by some 25% by 2030. The city says it's one of the few policy options available to it in attempting to meet the ambitious target. They've likened the scheme to a miles per gallon label on vehicles. If it sees the light of day, it'll provide another information tool to realtors and to home buyers themselves. Many realtors already use the popular Walk Score system to let house hunters know how far a particular dwelling is from local services like schools, libraries, and transit hubs, factors which often influence a home purchase decision. The initiative will, if implemented, give house hunters who care about the environmental impact of their daily lives a handy tool for deciding if a particular residence is for them. It will also give an indication of how expensive it might be to heat and to light. At the moment, homeowners are largely in the dark when it comes to energy efficiency, because many of the home design factors which affect it are not immediately obvious to the eye. A home energy score would, claims the city, remove the need for guesswork by providing a tangible, quantifiable measure which can be compared across a range of properties. The project is still in the research phase, but a consultation period for what the city calls concerned stakeholders will run from now until August, after which members of the public will get their say. Once the policy is refined, it's expected to go to a vote in September. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Les Hudson.
Whistleblowers who work for state government and nonprofit organizations will soon have better legal protection. Governor Kate Brown yesterday signed House Bill 4067. The bill allows workers to report potential wrongdoing to lawmakers, police, and attorneys who aren't connected to the information in question. It does not allow state workers to hand sensitive and proprietary information to the press. Bend Republican Representative Newt Bueller created the bill after the state employee who leaked some of then-Governor Kitzhaber's email was criminally charged.
The Willamette Falls locks and canal are a step closer to reopening thanks to $500,000 in state funding that Oregon Governor Kate Brown authorized yesterday. This funding will support the repair and reopening of the locks, which have been closed due to lack of funding since 2011. In 2012, the National Trust selected the Willamette Falls Locks and Canal as one of its national treasures. On the east bank of the Willamette, a team is designing a new river walk that will restore public access to the falls.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Next up is News from the BOO, followed by Occupy Portland at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is another sunny day with a high of 74. Evening skies will be clear with a low of 48.
Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The dictionary defines a patriot as one who loves his or her country and supports its authority and interests. Supports authority? Hooey! An American patriot is one who supports the egalitarian ideals of our country and is willing to challenge authority every time it devolves into authoritarianism. We see staggering levels of corporate authoritarianism asserting control over us in the Walmartification of our economy, Cokeification of our government, Murdochification of our media, Exxonification of our environment, Monsantoification of our food supply, and so on. Just keeping up with all the assaults on our people's democratic idealism can sometimes lead to an emotional overload that social commentator Marty Kaplan has dubbed informed citizen disorder. Symptoms include an outbreak of hives when you see Fox News and a nagging compulsion to flee to the woods, which is exactly what plutocratic powers want all dissidents to do. There is, however, a revitalizing antidote to the tragedy of ICD. Periodic exposure to America's mavericks and mutts, free thinkers and greed whackers who refuse to conform to the corporate order. They receive little media or political attention, but these are our nation's everyday patriots, wholly imbued with a stalwart spirit of fairness and justice. They're the underdogs battling big money and power, yet they commonly win. This is Jim Hightower saying, this populist spirit is flowing today all across our country, from dozens of battles against big oil frackers to numerous actions against the unconscionable labor practices of Walmart. Forget the overstuffed, business-as-usual politicians who keep running games on us for the preservation of the status quo. Our true history is not about the great men, but about the grassroots people. Just as in the original revolution, the democratic future and populist potential of America is in the heads and hands of rebels.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
61 drug offenders had their prison sentences commuted by President Obama today. A third of these inmates had life sentences. All are nonviolent offenders serving time under what the White House called outdated and unduly harsh sentencing laws. These commutations bring the total number of people granted clemency by Obama to 248, more than the past six presidents combined. Obama is committed to issue more grants of clemency during the remainder of his term.
Air gun blasting for oil along the Atlantic coast is coming under fire. According to data released today by ocean conservation group Oceana, areas off the U.S. Atlantic coast are threatened by seismic air gun blasting. Air gun blasting is a technique that drilling companies use to find potential oil and gas deposits trapped deep below the ocean floor. According to scientists at Oceana and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the air gun blasts are incredibly disruptive to marine life. Areas off the coast of Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Florida are being considered for seismic air gun blasting and happen to be critical habitats for many endangered marine species. Claire Douglas, the campaign director at Oceana, described the sound from seismic airgun blasts as being so loud that they can be heard up to 2,500 miles from their source, a stretch as big as the distance between Washington, D.C. and Las Vegas. Interests reliant on healthy ocean ecosystems have petitioned the federal government to express how harmful seismic blasting promises to be. This effort is a response to 75 leading marine scientists writing an open letter to President Obama last year, detailing, quote, the significant, widespread, and long-lasting impacts on fish and mammal populations in the area. It remains to be seen how the federal government will react to the widespread condemnation of this oil and gas exploration technique.
Police in Minnesota announced this morning there will be no charges brought against two officers involved in the death of 24-year-old Jamar Clark, who died the day after the encounter in November. The city has paid out $14 million to settle cases of police misconduct for incidents occurring between 2006 and 2012. In February, the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP filed a lawsuit to obtain video of the night Clark was shot, and those videos were released after the morning's press conference announcing the department's findings. A KABU reporter spoke with Raisha Williams of the Minneapolis NAACP about the release footage and about the rally planned for tonight.
A number of us were in the room when Mike Freeman gave his decision to not indict or further prosecute the police that were involved in the incident. So were we surprised? No. Were we disappointed? Absolutely. Here's another case where an African-American man in the United States, his injustices will not be brought to prosecution, and if they were, they probably wouldn't have been found guilty. And so we definitely plan on going to the location where Jamar was murdered this evening, which is on Plymouth Avenue, and we will have a vigil-like candle ceremony. We will be praying. We will talk to the community and try to keep everybody really calm and peaceful and talk through the process, but we will be on hand to support the community and make sure that it's a peaceful protest and rally.
Reports through service suggesting police in the area are donning riot gear. Is that something you can confirm?
Well, earlier they were. Immediately after the press conference, we know that there were police that were in riot gear and also militarized vehicles. We understand that the city is in high alert. We as a community are also on high alert. We know that tensions are running really high. Yet again, in the country of the United States where African Americans also pay taxes as citizens, our rights are being ignored and justice is not being brought to us. And so here we are in a situation where a community that is already victimized and over-policed will be policed this evening by military armed forces, who we know during the occupation antagonized peaceful protesters, abused us with rubber bullets, and also tear gassed us a number of times. And so while the city of Minneapolis likes to tell the narrative of police reacting to violent protesters, we know as a fact, being part of the protest, myself and many others, that that's not in truth the case. And what happens oftentimes is that we are the ones who are victimized and abused.
I know that your organization teamed up with the American Civil Liberties Union at the state level to request the videos of the night Mr. Clark died. Are you satisfied with the videos that have been released? Do they shed any light? Do they provide any clarity?
Well, no, we aren't satisfied with the videos that have been released. Even at the press conference, the videos that were released and showed during the press conference completely contradict what Mike Freeman gave in his report and his conclusion. So we know that the videos that Mike Freeman showed did not prove or support what he said in his statements. We're sure that there are videos out there that prove the statements of witnesses that came forward, and those videos have not been released. We know that there's a video of the two police officers who immediately after murdering Jamar were put in the exact same police car. And we know that there's a video from the police vehicle that has not been released. And if it is released, we want to get the audio for that. And so there's a number of videos that have not been released to the public that could support what the public is saying, will support what the number of witnesses on hand, over a dozen witnesses have said. And so are we satisfied with the videos that they've showed? No. They've released videos that support their narrative and really don't support it very well. I urge all individuals to go and research more about the case that Jamar Clark had just put forth against Minneapolis, the police department, for excessive force and abuse. He had just filed a lawsuit against them 2 weeks prior to his murder.
I've been talking with Raisha Williams from the NAACP in Minneapolis. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KABU News.
Israel's parliament just unanimously approved legislation that aims to limit the pay gap between bosses and workers. The new law, which applies to both the banking and the insurance industries, caps compensation at about $660,000 per year, or no more than 44 times the salary of the lowest paid worker in those industries. Anything above this ceiling would be subject to higher taxes. Recently, senior banker salaries in Israel have risen to as much as $2.1 million per year. The average salary in Israel is about $30,000 per year. In Europe, there has been strong opposition to any mandatory ratios of the highest allowable salaries compared to the lowest. In the U.S., financial firms must disclose what their pay ratios are, but there are no laws mandating what those ratios must be. The law has garnered widespread appeal from the Israeli government, but is being opposed by the banking community. Some critics have called it a populist measure that may lead to higher costs for the public if banks react by raising their charges for financial transactions. Israel's Association of Banks is expected to appeal the law in the country's Supreme Court.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed a conference in Geneva today, asking nations to accept more Syrian refugees in the coming years. Moon is asking wealthier nations to take in 480,000 refugees, but few nations are heeding the call to take in more. Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan currently host the largest populations of Syrian refugees, with a combined total of nearly 5 million. Last week, Turkey agreed to close off its border with Syria to prevent new refugees from entering. That move coincided with an increase in refugees coming through on boat routes to Greece. The U.S. is one of the three countries who responded to Moon's call to increase their pledges over the next few years. So far, the U.S. has pledged to take in just under 12,000 refugees by September 2016. According to a study published by Oxfam this week, the U.S. still isn't doing its, quote, fair share to resettle refugees, taking in just 7% of what their fair portion should be. So far, the U.S. has received fewer than 1,000 Syrian refugees.
Stuart Sugarman, known in Oregon as the People's Attorney, has died this week. Friends are gathering tomorrow, Thursday, March 31st, at Laurelhurst Park, Picnic Area E, at 6 p.m. KBOO's Lisa Loving has this memorial.
Almost every activist in Oregon has a Stu Sugarman story. As a public defender, he helped indigent clients charged with street-level offenses within the city of Portland. He also represented activists charged with crimes against the state within almost every political movement launched in Oregon over the past 20 years. Patrick Mazza, now a Delta 5 protester in Seattle agitating against liquefied natural gas shipments across the region, talked about Sugarman's work defending tree sitters and Earth First activists during the timber wars of the 1990s.
In 1996, after the salvage logging rider was passed, we formed something called the Action Resource Team, or ART. Joe Keating was the lead, and I did media, and Stu was the legal lead. It was like full service, soup to nuts, to go out to communities all around Oregon to help them stage actions against old growth logging unleashed by the salvage logging rider. This was when they were trying to move back into the woods after we had won some protection through the tree wars of the 80s and 90s. So I remember Stu as, you know, he was like there to help defend people, in all these civil disobedience actions we staged. And, he was a really deeply sincere, a deeply humble kind of guy. I know that there'll be lots of people missing him.
Photographer and activist Catherine Kendall speaks about Sugarman's presence 5 years ago at Occupy Portland.
I only met Stu at Occupy Portland in 2011, and I was very moved about how on scene he was, early in the morning, late in the day, available to people who might need to be defended for expressing their political views. And later, when I began to take some leadership in the Buddhist Peace Fellowship here in Portland, I asked him to be our consultant. And he came to a meeting of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship at the Central Library in March of 2015, and he said to us, I see that most of you are older white women. You are almost invulnerable. No policeman wants to be seen harming or arresting an older, nonviolent white woman. So you all are limited only by your imagination. Protest anything you want to protest. Go wherever you want to go. Demonstrate whatever you want to demonstrate. And not only am I behind you, but the force of this culture is behind you. So I was so inspired by that that I was kind of awestruck and have not been sure where to go. But I keep remembering that I'm limited only by my own imagination and what I can do and protest. And so I am so grateful to him. He was funny, and he laughed with us, and he made us laugh at ourselves, and I loved him dearly.
Anti-war, anti-fracking, old growth defenders, animal rights, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, everyday people caught up in the system. Sugarman embraced them all with free representation and warm fellowship. Stu Sugarman died Monday of suspected diabetes complications. He was just 52 years old. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Jamie Haddad, Galen Sanford, Robin Ryan, and Les Hudson. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Dr. David Berliner, co-author of the new book, 50 Myths and Lies That Threaten America's Public Schools, The Real Crisis in Education. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host David Diamond speaks with award-winning author Brian Evanson about his new collection of stories, A Collapse of Horses.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Just like Monica said, it is time once again for News from the Boo. Tonight, we won't have a live guest in studio. Instead, we're going to be hearing from web and new media director Jenka Soderberg about what's in store when we unveil our brand new website next week.
So I'm talking to Jenka. So first of all, can you tell us about your position at the station? What is it that you do exactly?
Well, I used to be the evening news and public affairs director. I started in that position in 2007 and was the evening news and public affairs director